So I think it's like, I don't mean to shift the discussion too much, but something really interesting happened while you were in Colombia. And basically, there's a documentary that you and Max Blumenthal directed together called Killing Gaza, which is really good, and people should go watch it. You can watch it for like $5 online. But that's not why I'm bringing this up to advertise your documentary. But it's to say there was this bookstore in Brooklyn or in New York. I don't know if it's Brooklyn or not, but it's a New York bookstore it's called Blue Stockings, that was going to be screening it for the DSA in the area. And then after they were lobbied by really just wonderful people, they actually decided to cancel the screening because Max Blumenthal is an Assadist, is how they said it. But I just think it's interesting that this happened while you were on the border with Venezuela in Colombia, dealing with a U.S. regime change scheme that there are some leftists in America or some self-described leftists in America who can't seem to get right. Or can't seem to bring themselves to just like straight up oppose what the U.S. is doing and are all like, well, I don't know, Maduro's kind of bad. And like, you know, I'm Venezuelan agency. Anyway, so I guess I'm just like wondering what your whole take on that was, just like being on the ground when like this blatant example of U.S. imperialism in real time is happening that's hurting people. And you're on the ground covering it, and then something gets, you know, this documentary you work on Gaza, not even on Syria, on Gaza, gets canceled because you and Max opposed the U.S. regime change scheme in Syria.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, once I found out that, like, Max and I were Assadists, then I just actually was like, I got to take Killing Gaza offline. So I've actually scrubbed it from the internet. I mean, it was so, it's just so asinine and just says everything about this, like, Brooklyn, like, I don't know, I call them like State Department socialists. They're like, we support like Bernie Sanders, but like we recite the State Department line about like every other country in the world. So, I mean, yeah, it's like I'm on the border of Venezuela, you know, I'm in Colombia on the border and talking to these like poor Venezuelans, and it's just so horrifying what they're going through. And then I see this, I didn't even actually know about it. And I barely heard about this, that this screening was even happening. And then I see a tweet that our screening is canceled because, you know, supposedly Max is an Assadist. And, I mean, it's like, it was just so stupid. I'm like, I mean, it's what you said. I'm watching the, you know, the new U.S. regime change war, and this group that, you know, I'm reporting on it, and this group is attacking our documentary on, like, Israel's genocide in Gaza because we opposed the last, you know, the other regime change, like, dirty war on Syria. And it's just like... It was just so foul and just shows how, you know, awful, like, this kind of, I don't know, I don't even consider these people leftists. I mean, they're, you know, at that point, it's like, if you're just going to side with U.S. dirty wars, then aren't you right?
Well, also, like, yeah, and also, it's just, what does Gaza have to do with anything? Like, it's like, there are so few documentaries to watch about Gaza that, like, you're really going to shut down something that has nothing to do with, like, it has, the documentary you guys made doesn't even have anything to do with Syria. Like, from my perspective, if some pro-opposition jackass, like, I don't even want to say pro-opposition, let me say pro-U.S. regime change war in Syria, let me put it that way. If some pro-U.S. regime change war person in Syria, like, made a really good documentary on Gaza, like, I wouldn't be, like, shut down the Gaza documentary because I don't like his politics on Syria. Like,
yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Stupid. It's so stupid. And it's like, way to do the Israel lobby's job for them. Like, really?
Exactly. I mean, they can't just disagree with you on an issue. Like, okay, like, for some reason, you know, you have a different understanding about Syria or whatever it is. Okay, fine. Like, that's a separate issue. But why censor a documentary about Palestine that, you know, I mean, I don't think there is another, not to like toot my own horn, but I don't think there's another documentary that like shows what the 2014 war on Gaza was, and like shows the aftermath. And I spent like, you know, I was in and out of there for 2+ years documenting that. And it's just so shameful to silence those voices as Palestine is, you know, still under attack. And, the, you know, people are just being gunned down every week at the Great March of Return. And, you know, it's just, it's sad and kind of disheartening to see that these, like, you know, identitarians, this identitarian bookstore is just totally succumb to a smear campaign that I think was pretty clearly orchestrated by Oz Chatterjee and Molly Crabapple. And, and so,
who, by the way, like, one of the things that really pissed me off is they were like, we have to respect the voices of the Palestinian and Syrian communities. Like which, I'm sorry, which voices? The voices of Molly Crabapple? Like, so when did she decide, like, who gets to speak for the Palestinian and Syrian community? And also, I don't like the selectiveness. Like, which Palestinians and Syrians are you talking about? Because,
yeah,
like,
they're tokenizing. You know, it's like, yeah, they're tokenizing, like, certain voices to say, oh, this is what all Palestinians think, or this is what all Syrians think.
And then what really pissed me off is this, like, well, why do we need to be screening a documentary by two white men? It's like, okay, so you want to silence all the voices of the Palestinians in Gaza that literally narrate the film?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if we didn't, you know, we intentionally did not put ourselves in the film. We just, we had to put a little bit of narration. And we, like, actually, that was a last minute decision, but we were intentionally not in the film. At one point, I will say, my knee makes a cameo. But you can't
so
even.
So is another white man taking up space.
Your white savior knee.
Yeah, yeah. So
you couldn't help yourself, Dan.
I had to.
You couldn't help it. But no, it's just like everything about it is so cynical and outrageous. And like, I don't know, that really made me angry. And then what really pisses me off is then, like, you know, you've got like Dima from Palestine Legal, like, talking back to them. It's like, what about this Palestinian right here? Like, it's like they're so selective in who gets to speak for this community that they think is so homogenous. It just really bothers me. And then someone responded to me, like, they were like, oh, who's up? Like, I was like, I'm so sick, like, as an Arab, like, I'm so sick of people defining, like, who gets to be the Arab, because, like, I'm never defined as, like, the voice.
Right.
My voice doesn't matter. I'm just, like, another white man, I guess. But then somebody, like, responded. They were like, you're, like, what, you're, they know, I wish I had it in front of me. It was something like, why are you, oh, you're complaining now about your, like, the oppression. Who's oppressing the Lebanese Druze voices? No one. And I was like, wait, what?
Oh, my God.
It was just so odd. Like, some, like, other Arab was coming at me. Like, I'm some sort of, like, I don't know. It just pissed me off. All of it, everything about this whole episode made me angry. Like, who cares about this one bookstore? It's not a huge deal. But then in the process of trying to get your film screened in some parts of, like, Lebanon, unfortunately, we've run into the same thing where there's these identitarians who are just like, we don't want to show this film because the directors are Assadists. And it's like, God, fuck off, people. Like, what is wrong with everyone?
There were a lot of, like, starving Palestinian children in Gaza who wouldn't talk to me because they said I'm an Assadist.
Yeah, right.
Oh, you mean they sit on their
Twitter? Well, no, but it's like, no, it's just interesting the voices that get to be promoted. Like, there was this one film out of Lebanon that I think was recently nominated for an Oscar that was like some like wealthy Lebanese director who's a woman.
I actually liked that movie.
Oh, did you? Well, it was a bit controversial because the movie, did you watch it? It's like,
I watched it.
Learn to cook? That one?
No, she goes into like this poor, it's like about going into these poor areas of Lebanon. And essentially the message that left with a lot of people was to blame the poor for their predicament. So it had a very, well, that's, I mean, there was a lot of really good critiques written of it. And people were, some people in Lebanon, especially a lot of leftists, were really upset about it.
Well, that's fine. I saw the movie.
They felt it was like a very neoliberal message that just like used these, because in general, she actually, the woman who made, like the director of the film, is quite, she even went into it blaming the poor, like their show for their predicament, because she's from like a wealthy background. My point is it's like there's only certain people who get elevated from this region as the voices you're supposed to listen to. And they're typically either wealthy and kind of promote the same narratives that like the capitalist class in these imperialist countries promote, or they are like from, they're like Palestinian American or Lebanese American or Syrian American from wealthy families. And like, it's the same with Venezuela. It's like a lot of the Venezuelans you're hearing from are like from Miami, and they're just like rich people who just like want to run the country and take everything away from the poor that's been given to them the last 20 years. And so it's just like, it's just amazing to me that you have these self-described leftists that keep falling for that and keep falling for these like literally State Department talking points about like, we have to respect what Venezuelans, what Palestinians, you know, what Syrians want. And they want us to bomb and destroy their countries. And anybody who suggests otherwise is just a stupid white man, or like, we should just pretend they don't exist if they're actually from that country.
Definitely. I mean, yeah, it's the same script over and over again. I mean, like Joanna Hausman, this like this New York comedian who, you know, made these like viral videos about like, this is about, she's, I guess, from Venezuela. Her father is Ricardo Hausman. He's like, he was the director or somehow high up in the IMF. I mean, and he's basically like wrote out the playbook of how to destroy Venezuela, how to like do regime change. And she's making videos like, I am Venezuelan and this is not a coup. And we have to just take back our democracy. And Trump is like, she's like hates on Trump so much if you look through her tweets. But she's like, in this case, Trump is right. And Trump is doing good. And
it's yeah, like, you know, people like people, I was seeing her video but on my Facebook feed and people were like, I don't know what to believe. Like that shit works.
It's really effective.
That, it really is effective. And I mean, if you actually watch her video, she doesn't actually present any facts. She just tells you, she's like, it's not a coup. Okay. I'm going to tell you why. And then she never really tells you why, but she's just like, my own family is in jail. Like that's what she says. And then she just like goes from this, like she ends it practically crying.
Well, her uncle is some kind of journalist, and he is in prison. I'm not sure what. So, I mean, there are questions about that, but it's like, even if there's like, whatever, there's flaws with, you know, the Venezuelan government, that doesn't mean that, you know, the answer is to like destroy the country. And just starve it and basically kill a bunch of people. And not only that, I mean, Joanna Hausman does not sound like most Venezuelans do. I'll put it this way. The starving Venezuelans I met in Cucuta who are begging in the streets, they look a whole lot different. They have a much darker skin. You know, it's like poor people. I mean, it's like,
I mean, those are the people that the opposition wants to take subsidies away from. Like,
exactly. Exactly.
All of this is such a huge joke, and I'm really glad that there are people like you who are able to go there. And you know what this really demonstrated to me is just how awful, I mean, I know this already, but it's always like good to have a reminder, I guess, but like there was literally no media outlet in the US that's mainstream that you can look to for accurate information on Venezuela. Mm-hmm. It's almost shocking, actually, like across the board. It's either like the work you're doing for RT or like Democracy Now, that's it.
And not only that, they changed their their Twitter cover header things have markings or emblems that are like identified with the opposition or like Venezuela and President Guaido and stuff like that.
Who did?
Well, I think like The Economist changed it.
The Economist and Reuters. Yeah, I caught those. I tweeted it out. A couple, I don't know, it must have been a month ago now. The Economist and Reuters Latin America both changed their header photos to pictures of Guaido.
Jesus Christ. Like, the Economist is just like, The Economist is just like jerking off and like coming on camera for everyone. They're like, oh my God, we want regime change so bad.
Rania, I thought we were toning down the eroticism.
I couldn't help it. No, but they really are. It's like they're like turned on. The Economist can't help but like cheerlead it. They're just like, oh my God, like they're excited.
It's unbelievable. I mean, you know, maybe we could talk a little bit about Guaido's background. I mean,
yeah, that's a good thing to end on, actually. Like, you did.
I had another question, but yeah,
go ahead, ask your question first, because I do want, like, I think Dan should also talk about his piece on Guaido.
Yeah, I mean, his whole thing about Guaido will probably feed into this. I just had a larger question for you because actually we Rania had forgotten that we had had you on the show, and I guess I sort of did.
Totally forgot. I was like, I'm sorry, Dan.
but our show is very different. Like from the, I mean, we've grown a lot, so it's fair that like, you know, what we're known for now, it's like we were just sort of this like fledgling show that we were trying to produce like every other week if we had the time within our journalist schedules, and now it's more regular. We talked to you back then. I think there had just been a snowstorm in Gaza, I want to say, and we had just talked to you. I believe that's correct. Mm-hmm. But anyways, my larger question was just sort of like your experience, because we haven't talked to you just under Donald Trump. I mean, when we were talking to you, we had President Barack Obama, and I'm just wondering like how you feel about the shift, because a lot of what you're covering is foreign policy, and you're talking about this thing of State Department socialists and, you know, the way people express their opposition to certain acts of the United States. So I'm wondering, like, how you feel, you know, the change in power, the change in political dynamics, and like what's happened to maybe Democratic Party politics, how that has maybe affected your reporting. I mean, particularly, like, I mean, you being an RT reporter, that has to impact, you know, your ability to get out what you're trying to share about the world. But then on a larger level, it's like any sort of thing that we're talking critically immediately gets identified with either Trump, or you're conspiring with like a foreign power that is an adversary of the United States.
You know, when I compare the Trump era and the Obama era, I think there's actually a lot of similarities to these two presidents in a certain way. Now, consider when Obama came into power, he basically ran on this platform of like people were tired of Bush, tired of these like endless wars, and he said hope and change, and we're going to do things differently and have kind of like a new beginning, right? And it was kind of like hope and change for the left. And then what did he do? He just continued wars and then destroyed Libya and, you know, I mean, largely continued the Bush era policies, and then also let, you know, all the neocons from the Bush administration off the hook. And then people were tired of the like neoliberal status quo under the Obama administration. And Donald Trump says, you know, we're arming terrorists in Syria and Libya is a disaster. And what are we doing? Iraq and this and that. And he had mixed messaging, but he did speak out against war, and that, and you know, made him appear as an alternative to the status quo, but more to the right, as well. Obama was to the left. And what does he do when he gets into power? Well, more war. And now he's, you know, trying with Venezuela. So there's a certain, like, both of them are kind of similar in that way that they lied and said we're going to end these wars to, you know, Obama to the left, Trump to the right. And in terms of how, you know, the left has responded to, and that, you know, the Democratic Party, which is not really the left, but kind of, you know, the broader blob has responded to the Trump era. I mean, I think it's largely been really disappointing and shows a lot about, you know, how fractured the left is in this country. I mean, the Democratic Party kind of lines up behind Trump when he's ready to bomb, whether it was, you know, in Syria when he was ready to, you know, talking about taking out Animal Assad, or when it's, you know, this Venezuela stuff. They're almost everyone is lined up behind him there, and see, you know, Trump, it's kind of like a broken clock is like right, you know, twice per day is the way they see it, I think. And, you know, oh, he's actually like learning to be presidential, that sort of thing. I think, you know, for me being at RT, it's kind of, you know, I used to get like a lot of love from like the kind of broader left in the U.S. when I did my Palestine reporting, because for one thing, it wasn't that, you know, my reporting wasn't that controversial for them. It was like a pretty clear cut and dry thing. But, you know, since I started working at RT and expanding my reporting to, you know, I think as you two have experienced too, you start getting ostracized by kind of like these soft, confused, you know, leftists, you know, supposed leftists who don't really have a principled understanding of what's going on around them and see things purely in terms of like, you know, this is authoritarianism. It's like the word they use a lot. Or, and so for me inside RT, I have total editorial freedom. I mean, I pitch stories, I get assigned stories, but like, no one tells me like, this is the line you need to take. And so it's been really, I mean, I've learned so much inside RT. And it's been really, freeing in a lot of ways. Not that I didn't have, you know, editorial freedom before, but now I have like resources behind me, and like, you know, I could get to Columbia and do my reporting and just hit it from the ground. And we did a special yesterday, and I just got to sit up there, sit at, you know, the desk with my colleague Manila Chan, and just talk about what I observed on the ground. And it's, you know, it's such a disservice to, you know, to the American public to demonize RT in the way it has been. And not that RT is perfect. I mean, there's, you know, I have my criticisms, and there's a lot of room for criticism, but it's true that, you know, it's really the only, I mean, RT is the biggest channel in the world, actually. Biggest news outlet in the world. And there are so few spaces inside the US for anti-imperialists to be able to do journalism that RT is, you know, one of the very, very few. And so to see that it's just so demonized, and a lot of it comes from the intelligence agencies, you know, it's all based on like what the CIA and the FBI and the DIA say about, you know, that RT is Russian propaganda. And it's like, you know, I actually did a piece recently where I proved that the idea that RT is Russian propaganda is actually US government propaganda. And so, you know, I think that's what really people need to know. And instead of saying, you know, treating people like idiots, like, oh, you shouldn't listen to RT because it's propaganda. It's like, well, I think people, you know, need to understand the concept of media literacy, that there is no perfect media outlet, and that the best thing to do is, you know, read as much as you can and learn how to, you know, understand nuance and look at different media outlets and compare them. What are they saying here? What are they saying here? What is their credibility? Have they lied, you know, about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, like the New York Times did, and so many other media outlets? And I think that's really the approach people need to take. But, you know, we get like gaslit so much about, oh, we're consuming propaganda, and it's like infiltrated your mind. And can I even trust my thoughts anymore? And, you know, is Putin controlling my mind through this guy who I thought was like a leftist, and blah, blah, blah. And so it's so destructive, I think, to public discourse. And it's really kind of, you know, frightening for not only the present, but what the future of the U.S. is.
I'll just note before you go to your piece and anything Rania has, that there's this thing on New York Times right now. The headline reads, "Live from America's Capital, a TV station run by China's Communist Party, CGTN America, which is based in Washington and available in 30 million U.S. households, insists it does not do Beijing's bidding. Some people, however, are skeptical." And I just raise that in the confines of this discussion because it seems like we have this really twisted discussion about state-funded media, and it's really detrimental to press freedom and the ability to have like a free press.
Well, I mean, I gotta say, I think that you guys both make really good points. I mean, the U.S. spends, I think, like $500 million a year, if I'm not mistaken. I could be making that up, but it's like a ridiculous amount of money on media around the world. They see it as a form of soft power. And they dominate the US narrative, the Western narrative dominates world media. It really, really does. And so one of the reasons these other countries do this, like fund media outlets, is to offer a different perspective. And they have every right to do that. And we like, and it just, it's like a natural fit when there's people in the US who like can't, who don't get platforms anywhere else, you find a platform where you can offer that alternative perspective of reality that actually is real. Like, that's reality you're presenting. And again, like Dan said, it doesn't mean that everything you see on RT is right or RT's perfect. But this like demonization campaign against these particular channels is obviously very politically motivated, and is a way to shut down this alternative like platform and alternative voice. It really is. And I really do think that, you know, Dan's not wrong. RT International is huge. RT Arabic is huge. It's a wildly popular and considered like a very credible outlet in this region. And like this also has to do, I think, with these mainstream outlets being scared of being challenged as well, because right now they run the show. And so, I mean, CNN, like, look what happened with the outlet I work for. CNN went out of its freaking way to try and have this, like, have us, like, scrubbed from the internet. Like, they can't handle any competition, no matter how minor. So I think it's, like, all really, it's important to consider all of that when you think about these outlets. And, like, don't fall for the demonization. Like, think about it. These outlets, like New York Times and CNN, they want you to believe that, like, you shouldn't even bother watching these channels. Like,
it's like detrimental.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I mean, you're an adult. Like, it's like, why can't we like allow people to decide for themselves?
Definitely. It treats people so infantile. I mean, the other thing is it's also very much like just in the US.
Yeah. And maybe also the UK a bit, but I think.
And in like, and in Western Europe, Western Europe to a degree too. Yes. But like in the US, it's so crazy, the demonization of RT. But like, you know, I mean, in Latin America,
people like don't give a shit.
RT's Spanish channel is huge. In Latin America, people look to RT Spanish so much because there's really nothing else. I mean, it's like kind of, you know, just shows what a like little petri dish the like US left is. What a bubble.
Also, but like the West, I mean, really, like the arrogance of people living in the West is just so stunning to me. Like, you are a minority in the world, like, as a Westerner.
Right. People like, think it's like the center of the world. Like, Brooklyn is the center of the universe. And
I mean, like, Europe is like really tiny compared. I mean, when you compare it to like China, like South Asia, the Middle East, Africa, Latin America, and what the fuck? Okay, like on a side note, Australia. How did this place end up white? I'm still very confused. Like the fact that this place is like planted in the global South next to all these brown countries and is white doesn't make people like go, what? How the fuck did that happen? Is really funny to me, but like. Seriously, though, like outside of these Western countries and Australia that considers itself a Western country, even though it's not in the West, outside of these places, like the world is much, much bigger and most of the world's population is in these other parts of the world that we like to pretend don't exist. So it's just like the level of arrogance that the West thinks it should be able to like dominate the entire narrative. And anyone who challenges that must be crushed and must be doing the bidding of like the evil people, because we're the good people, we're the good guys. It's just such a neocon mindset. And it's really scary how many people fall for it.
It's become so prevalent. I mean, it's kind of terrifying, but you know, but then at the same time, like when I go out and report on the ground in the US, people are like, oh, RT, I love RT. You know, I used to watch like Abby Martin show or like this or that, or I love Lee Camp or whatever it is. And it's like, you know, social media is like also only reflective of like a certain like class, a certain like cross section of people who like, you know, use it religiously like we do. So,
also, like, I will say a lot of this demonization is also an attempt to make it impossible for you to find people to interview.
That's very true.
And it like limits, because like the kinds of stories someone like you or I want to tell are stories that like, you know, reflect on like I want to go talk to teachers who have two or three jobs. Mm-hmm, to get right. by because teachers are paid like are so underpaid in the US. And so like when you're doing that as somebody who works for an outlet that's either RT or affiliated with it, it's like people think twice about being interviewed by you if they're politically aware of all this like, you know, who you should and shouldn't talk to bullshit. And so it's also just a way to limit your ability to tell stories as a journalist.
And it'll happen in a way where you know, people who are potential guests might think twice about coming. And just
I'm completely certain too that like it like there's people I've invited on our podcast that I'm like I don't know for sure, but I'm pretty convinced part of the reason they either don't respond, they haven't responded, is because they're like, no, Rania's too toxic because of her, because of where she works. I'm certain that that's part of it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's people who are, you know, who are like, oh, I'm a leftist. I'm such a leftist. I'm a socialist. I support Bernie. But ew, oh my God, I won't talk to those people because they're too toxic and everybody calls them Assadists. And they're not trust fund journalists. So they have jobs at Russian affiliated outlets. Oh my God.
Right. I mean, you know, that's true. And they're like, there's the people who are like, oh my God, it's Russian propaganda. And there's people who are like, maybe it's just better if I don't, cause like, you know, I don't know what's going to happen.
I don't want to get called what you get called.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, for a few months ago, I did just like a short report on cell phone radiation, and like health risks and 5G. And I found the most like unbelievable information about how cell phone radiation is actually horrible for human health and environmental health. And I just kind of went into this rabbit hole of like cell phone radiation, and I just learned so much, and it's so, so crazy. And when I did this, I got these experts reached out to me, one of which was a doctor appointed by the Clinton administration to, you know, oversee some kind of public health program. I mean, she's like one of the top doctors in the country. And then another one is like an expert who like runs this organization with her. And they reached out to me, you know, just an RT America reporter who did just like a quick report on it, because they told me they've had stories with the New York Times, with the Washington Post, with Time Magazine, and the journalists did all the research and were ready to publish, and the editors killed it at the last minute, killed these stories. And it's because these outlets are basically controlled by their advertisers and big wireless, which is a huge, huge industry on the level of like big oil or big tobacco, that's only come up in the last like, you know, 20 years or so, and people don't really know about it. And so the only place that they could go to publish this kind of information that has like major repercussions for human health is RT, because we're not controlled by these, you know, advertisers. So, you know, it's really extra. I think it's important for America, for RT and outlets like that, or CGTN, for foreign media that's not subservient to, you know, corporations and the U.S. government, which essentially have the same interests, to be able to broadcast in the U.S. It's important for, you know, democracy and the well-being of, you know, Americans.
Well, I was just going to say, that's a really good point, because in the conversation about state-funded media, we always, for some reason in the U.S., seem to just assume that corporate media funding, like corporate funding, is okay. Like, right. State funding is evil, but corporate funding is friendly.
Right, right. And it's not transparent at all. It's like, okay, no. I work for RT. That means Russia Today. Who's paying? Who pays for Russia Today? Well, Russia. Who pays for CNN?
So difficult, by the way. It's MSNBC. Like, it's really, 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 really difficult to figure out exactly what these outlets, like whose dollars they're relying on. It exactly. really is not an easy exactly. thing to do.
I mean, it's like, okay, am I representing, you know, can you say I'm representing the Russian government's interests? I guess to a degree. I mean, not in any direct way, but like, I guess if Russia didn't benefit from having RT, then sure, they probably wouldn't, you know, put money into having this outlet.
Right.
But like, what about, you know, The Intercept is owned by Pierre Omidyar, this like, you know, Silicon Valley made like regime change billionaire. How many people know that, you know, that's who like funds The Intercept, who's like, you know, considered like the kind of woke, like left outlet that's like adversarial and for like these kind of celebrity left journalists? I mean, there's like no transparency. And so for me, I'm like, well, you know, sure, I would love to like just have my own, to not need money to do journalism. But at the end of the day, like, every journalist needs to have some funding to like pay the bills and eat food. So, I think it's good to have transparency. I just think it should be applied across the board.
Mm-hmm. I agree 100%.
Well, why don't we have you talk about your piece on Juan Guaido and some of what was important about that before we wrap here.
Right. So Juan Guaido, you know, who's this coup leader in Venezuela, Basically, he was a no-name figure, like a middling figure in the most discredited far-right opposition party that over the past, you know, since 2014, when these violent guarimbas, you know, started breaking out, the Popular Will Party that he helped found in 2009 has been totally discredited, even among the opposition. Juan Guaido himself was elected to the to be a deputy lawmaker. He came in second place in his race. He was never elected to head the National Assembly, which he became the president of as a result of a power-sharing agreement. And that's how he got to, you know, so when they say he's like head of the president of the National Assembly, it's not because he was elected. It's just because he happened to be there. Now, his background, this is where it gets really shocking. Now, he's part of what they call Generation 2007. And this is when Hugo Chavez, then president of Venezuela, was attempting to pass a constitutional reform that would have created essentially the framework for what he called 21st century socialism, which is, you know, cutting down the workday, you know, healthcare, housing, all these kinds of things, which was pretty, you know, visionary for the time. Juan Guaido and was part of a student movement from like an elite university in Caracas. He and his fellow students they were actually trained that year in 2007. These guys were trained in 2007 in the first of a series of trainings done by an organization called Canvas. Now, to understand what Canvas is, we have to go back to Serbia, to Yugoslavia in 1998, when the U.S. and the CIA basically started funding a student group in Yugoslavia to overthrow the government of Slobodan Milosevic. This student group got a bunch of money from the CIA, got training from the U.S. government in the basically what they call how to bring down a dictator, the tactics of Gene Sharp, and it's basically like how to wage like insurgency against the government. And so they were successful in 2000. They bring down Milosevic. Then the veterans of this group, these students, they grow up and they start basically a for-profit regime change mercenary program called CANVAS, Center for Applied Nonviolent Action Strategies. And they get money from the CIA, from the State Department, from all over the place, all these like U.S. government arms to basically partake, to train students across Central Asia in the color revolutions in the former, you know, Soviet satellite states, who were basically in the Russian sphere of influence. And they had these color revolutions to bring them into the Western sphere of influence. And so in 2007, they started, WikiLeaks released some documents that showed the State Department said like, okay, it's time for Venezuela. And we've identified these student leaders, which were Juan Guaido's, the guys who were above Juan Guaido in the, what became the Popular Will Party. And so they actually had a major success, the student movement, after their training by this group, Canvas, in 2007. They defeated Hugo Chavez's constitutional reform. And then in 2009, they eventually passed it. And then in 2010, Juan Guaido allegedly, this is according to documents released by the Venezuelan government, went to a training in Mexico. And they call this the Fiesta Mexicana plot, like the Mexican party plot. Where he, along with this exiled oligarch named Pedro Borelli, who I actually I confronted at that Organization for American States rally because he called for the assassination of Maduro. He funded it along with a couple of other exiled oligarchs and who are very much, you know, part of the gas and oil industry in Mexico and Canada. I mean, just the most unsavory characters. And there was a plot to assassinate Chavez at that point. and then to overthrow the government. So basically, it's Juan Guaido is part of a long-term plot, and what they needed essentially was to, you know, they're waiting for the rollback of the pink tide across Latin America, you know, Argentina, Brazil, you know, Lula in prison, all of these like progressive forces that had come to power in Latin America and really raised the standard of living, brought millions and millions of people out of poverty. This is kind of essentially ending in the last couple of years. And then with the election of Bolsonaro in Brazil, you have Duque in Colombia, all of these right-wing guys that are in the U.S. sphere of influence, they decided now is the time, but to do this, you know, coup in Venezuela. And so all of the guys above Guaido, as I said before, were kind of out of the country because they had been at least accused, alleged that they partook in like terrorist plots. And so a lot of these guys are in Washington now. And so Juan Guaido is like this low figure in the party, but he gets propelled up and even skipped over partially because of his image. He has like a wife and newborn baby, and he's, you know, hasn't been like arrested before. But so we did this investigation, like laying this whole thing out and explaining how Juan Guaido is essentially, you know, trained by the U.S. regime change mercenary arms. And Mike Pence calls him the day before January 22nd. Mike Pence calls Juan Guaido and says, declare yourself president and the U.S. will support you. And until that moment, Guaido was not really, you know, sure if this is a good idea. And then he did it. And then, you know, that's when it all kicked off. So Juan Guaido basically has daily phone calls with Venezuelan oligarchs, I've learned, with Pedro Borrelli. He's very clearly taking his orders from the White House, from Marco Rubio, from John Bolton. And so he's basically a pawn in the U.S. regime change plot. So, you know, because he's such a low-level figure, he doesn't really matter so much what happens to him. The real player in the Venezuelan opposition is Leopoldo López, who is under house arrest in Venezuela and, you know, as far as I can tell, is also having daily phone calls with Guaido to basically direct him. And so if, you know, the coup were to really happen, whether it's Guaido who's, you know, they call the president or not, Leopoldo López and figures like that are really, you know, the characters who are going to be running the show. But I really encourage, you know, all you know, the listeners to check out that article, to check out our article at Gray Zone Project. You know, really kind of goes in depth to who Juan Guaido is and how this whole regime change project happened.
It's worth noting very quickly here before we sign off that apparently the Washington Post reported back in early 2017 that the wife of Leopoldo, Lillian Tintori, met with Donald Trump, and there was a photo. It was tweeted out, and it was something that was pleasing to Marco Rubio. It was, I think, Mike Pence played kind of a role in introducing Trump and Lillian to each other. But that's basically when it seems like Donald Trump took this started becoming pretty fascinated with targeting Venezuela.
Yes, that has. I think that has a lot to do with it. I mean, I think, you know, it's like Trump is basically listening to the Miami right wing, you know, Latino lobby too. And, one, I think, important element to consider about, you know, why Trump is doing this is because, you know, it's election season is coming up. And so this is a way for him to get neocons on his side, to get Florida Republicans on his side, which is very crucial for Trump. So, you know, we see him really, you know, not only talking about Venezuela, but also Cuba and Nicaragua. And then there's, you know, the other thing to consider is Mexico, which just, you know, recently elected their like kind of social democrat leader, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who, you know, has, I mean, a lot of people are excited about and has a lot of promise. And there's actually a podcast that this oligarch who lives in Virginia, Pedro Borelli, was on. It's actually Michael Morell, the former CIA director's podcast, which is on CBS, where he talked about it. And he said, this is a message to AMLO, that if you try anything, we're going to come for you. So, you know, it's really about the U.S. trying to just assert entire dominance over its, you know, what it calls its backyard, you know, the old Monroe Doctrine in Latin America. But, you know, I think part of Donald Trump being president is it's a symptom of the U.S. empire in decline, like the golden age where neocons could just say, we're going to take out Iraq and we're going to, you know, do this and that. That's kind of over. And their coup, I mean, we saw in Syria, they failed. You know, they said Assad would be gone years ago. He's basically reasserted, you know, control over almost the entire country. And now, you know, with Venezuela, it was like, well, this, you know, are the Russians and the Chinese really going to like allow this to happen? You know, are they going to step in? Probably not, because it's so close to the U.S. It's far away from them. It's more economic interest than any security interest. But, I mean, I think we've really seen that the U.S. coup in Venezuela has failed to this point. There's not going to be a military intervention. They're just going to try to starve the population and, you know, have like a junta, a military junta. But the U.S., you know, golden age of just being able to do whatever it wants, even in Latin America, seems to be over. And, you know, I think that's actually something to celebrate.
So the last thing I want to get in here, and then Rania, whatever you have, but I think it also needs to be said that there's a dual value to what Donald Trump is doing, and the Republicans and him know it quite well. And this is why it's important to have your voice out there. It's important for Rania's voice. It's important for everyone who's strongly opposing Venezuela to speak and also dig into the reality of what's going on in the country, because Donald Trump sees it as a failed socialist state. And so not only is he trying to destroy a people and a country, but he's using it to turn against any sort of promotion of what are really socialist ideas in America that are very appealing to people at a grassroots level right now who believe in these things, regardless of what the Democratic politicians, including Bernie Sanders, are saying. People are really want to go the full mile to implement a lot of things that could really help people.
Definitely. I mean, you know, it's funny. Socialism and like communism are like dirty words in the U.S. And there's like this anti-communist kind of religion. It's like the real religion of the U.S. But if you say it, you know, what do you think about socialism to the average person? You know, maybe they're going to say like something they don't like it, or, you know, that sounds like authoritarian or something. But then if you say, well, you know, what about you know, should the government like fix potholes, or like, you know, there's now the idea of like of healthcare, of public healthcare is, you know, popularizing. Or, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of homelessness. These are things that are like that are reality for people. And I think when you put it in those terms, then people are like, well, yeah, that's something that I would like. And Donald Trump is just railing against this idea because he sees it, and correctly so, as the ultimate threat and the antithesis of, you know, the destruction of the working class in the U.S. that, you know, neoliberalism has created. Donald Trump himself is a product of neoliberalism. So, I mean, it's not even, you know, he's not even railing against, when it comes to Venezuela, Trump is not even railing against, like, you know, dictatorship or, you know, supposed dictatorship or authoritarianism so much as about socialism, because he knows that it has, you know, in a way, they know it has an appeal to working class Americans who are just like suffering, as, you know, wages have fallen and all the wealth has gone to billionaires.
No, absolutely. And I'm just like reminded of the State of the Union address where Trump was like, we will never be a socialist country. And like Chuck Schumer, you know, was the first to like stand up and clap for him, along with other Democrats who were like, hell yeah, we won't. And it just kind of goes to show you that it's not just Trump's worst nightmare. And I think that, you know, Kevin made this point recently in a piece he wrote about Bernie Sanders' like annoying response to the whole Venezuela situation, is that it's really crucial for these so-called democratic socialists to stand strongly and loudly against this regime change operation in Venezuela and all its disgustingness, not just against military intervention, but against all U.S. meddling, because it's going to be used in this upcoming election in the U.S. by the right and by probably centrists, maybe, to try to discredit these democratic socialists. They're going to be like, but look at Venezuela. They already do that.
Yeah.
And your answer can't. And I mean, Kevin, you can go ahead and take. I think you had.
Well, that was sort of my question to Dan. It was, I wasn't intending to boost my article, but thank you for mentioning it. My thing was that, yeah, we can't just talk about this as like a military intervention issue. You have to talk about not only the economic warfare, because you really, you know, there's no mention of sanctions, to be clear, as we're wrapping here. There's no mention of sanctions. But then even so, to actually be very specific about the way we talk about the Venezuela government, because while there are valid left-wing critiques, I think we need to be very leery about what we're allowing to be weaponized against the Venezuela government, because, you know, I don't know if as an American right now, I have the luxury to sit here in this country and tell people how I think Maduro should be running Venezuela, because one, I don't live in Venezuela, but two, the government of my country is actually trying to destabilize and overthrow the regime of Nicolas Maduro. So there's no way anyone should take an American voice who's trying to use a common phrase, to basically do Monday morning quarterbacking of Nicolas Maduro's government. There's no way anybody there should take me seriously, because I presume I have ulterior motives to actually participate in boosting people who are trying to overthrow their government. So my responsibility, and I think Ronnie and you both would agree, is to be very clear about what the U.S. is trying to do to Venezuela, and stay very focused upon that, and to also, you know, dig into the mythology around what happened with the election in May 2018, what kind of government do they have, what is it with this constituent assembly? There's all kinds of lies about whether that constituent assembly is fraudulent or an abuse of power. And so you just have to be very specific and clear, and to tell people what's going on, so that it's not used to push regime change.
Definitely. I mean, it's so important for, you know, Americans who want to do, want better things, like want to help Venezuelans. And it's like, the best thing to do is let Venezuelans figure out their own issues. I mean, you know, I don't profess to be some kind of expert on Venezuela, but I mean, I think it's very clear that the most destructive thing for Venezuelans is an economic crisis that's imposed from the outside. And so it's like, I think, you know, so many people who have kind of good intentions on the left end up being, well, it's like, well, I have to, like, you know, be morally, they think it's like a matter of moral consistency to be like, Maduro's bad because who knows why, and Trump is bad, and it's the same. And it's like, no, the reality is, Venezuela, you know, he is the elected president, and, you know, the solution for whatever problems Venezuela has to come from inside Venezuela. And so it's, you know, we're living in real life. It's not like a theoretical exercise. And so so what we need to do right now is keep the U.S. out of Venezuela, and allow Venezuelans to figure out their own problems. And when we fund these like fanatical parties, it just polarizes Venezuela, and it, you know, really reduces the chances that these things can be worked out through negotiations, and, you know, through dialogue. So, you know, hopefully, you know, people will take that to heart and start to understand, you know, these kinds of geopolitical conflicts through, you know, a contact through, you know, a lens of material reality, rather than like, you know, exercises, mental exercises.
Or like, at the very least, maybe instead of spending $1 billion a year on like controlling the world in really violent, repressive ways so that American oligarchs can keep getting richer, we could maybe stop spending it on that and start spending it on all these social programs that these social democrats want to enact in the US. Like, I just think it's funny, Bernie Sanders, just as we were having this conversation, and because I'm so ADD and I have to do 1,000 things at the same time or I'll go crazy. I think it's funny, Bernie Sanders just tweeted, he said, about military spending. He says, sorry, I'm waiting for it to load because I have very slow internet. Okay, so he says, if we can spend over $700 billion on our military every year, we can certainly make public colleges and universities tuition free in America. And he's totally right, but I like wish he'd take it a step further and say, how about instead of spending $700 million on our like empire every year, we make public colleges and universities tuition free in America, which we can do for a fraction of that.
Yeah, it's such a lame argument. It's such a lame argument that Sanders is putting forth. It's like, well, we can bomb the hell out of other countries and destroy socialist countries and whatever else, and we can have like, you know, some kind of version of
socialism. I mean, to be fair, he's like not necessarily saying we should keep doing it, but it's like, dude, take it a step further. Like, seriously, take it a step further.
Yeah.
Enough with this, like, if we can spend money on destroying countries, then we can certainly do this. How about like you go to the next place and go, hey, like one of the reasons that we don't get to spend money on all this is because all our money goes to this.
Exactly.
Like, I don't know why that's so difficult. I mean, granted, maybe if he said that, he'd get shot. I don't know. But, like...
I don't know. I think people would respond to it really well. I mean,
I think they would. I think they would, too. I do. And, like, I just... I'm like, you guys, come on. Take it a step further. Like, and also, with, you know, I really... With Bernie Sanders, I'm like, dude, like, you go and watch these videos of him from the 80s talking about the Contras and the Sandinistas. And you talk like he's like calling Reagan a fascist. Like I'm like you've got to know what's happening in Venezuela. Like just apply right. The same logic. He's got it. Like I'm just like if you don't, then my God. But then I also see videos of him. Like oh my God, if you see the video of him call like supporting and like encouraging the bombing of Yugoslavia, it's one of the worst things to watch when he's in Congress because he's just like NATO is fully justified, and you're just like oh my God, it's like painful. It's actually painful. So I don't know. Obviously, like, I do support Sanders, and, like, I do think, like, I still have $20,000 in student debt. So, like, I really would love there to be a president who can get rid of that. And I'm kind of banking on it. Like, I really am. Like, a part of me is just like, Sanders will get rid of it. He'll take care of it. But aside from that, like, it's like we got to move past just that. Like, let's expand the conversation a little bit, you guys, beyond just, like, let the things you want domestically and then trying to come up with weird, convoluted ways to pay for them instead of just the most obvious way.
Right. Which is, well, it's, yeah, it's just, like, a total paradox because, like, you know, at the end of the day, there is, like, a war being waged on the working class in the U.S., and there's a war being waged on the working class outside of the U.S., and that's through military and through sanctions. And so, like, the consistent, you know, the consistent line to take would be, like, end all of that war, end all of that class war, and then we can all have it better. I mean, there's no reason not.
Well, and I think the thing is that, like, a lot of these arguments that are popular right now were made to some degree, maybe not as extensively, but to some degree by progressives about 10 or 15 years ago, and we need to advance. Like, the people who claim to be leading any kind of opposition, they have to sharpen their analysis. It's just tired, and it's inadequate for what we're facing.
Definitely.
Absolutely, absolutely. And also, there's one last thing I want to say that, like, has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but I'm going to say it anyways. Just because you just made me think of it, Kevin, is like one thing they could make sharper is like I do like obviously I'm all about universal healthcare, but like they keep saying Medicare for all, which sounds cool, but like now that my dad has Medicare, it's like not sufficient. Like, did you know that you have to buy an extra healthcare plan like to supplement your Medicare because it doesn't cover everything? Like, even Medicare kind of sucks. Like, it's I know it's a popular program because people desperately need it, but, like, even that needs to be better. Like, I don't know. Sometimes I'm just like, and then I hear a lot of the same rhetoric. Like, I'm starting to hear certain politicians talk about single payer, and I'm like, isn't this the same conversation? Like, I hope, maybe I'm just being cynical. I hope we've advanced to, like, demanding universal health care. But then didn't we have this conversation under, like, when Obama became president about single payer and, like, universal health care? And everybody was like, yeah, yeah, it's going to happen. And then it didn't because, like, we settled. And sometimes I fear, like, we're getting into that same trap again. I don't know. But I guess we'll have to wait and see. But in the meantime, you guys, stop supporting the bombing of the rest of the world.
All right, well, it was great to have you on, Dan, to talk.
For like 2 hours.
We were making up for all the previous seasons of our show when we didn't invite you on.
Yeah.
All right, definitely. Well, I appreciate it. And hopefully...
It was so good, Dan. Thank you for, like, walking us through all of that exhaustive... It was very exhaustive. Thank you. We really, really appreciate it.
Definitely. Thank you for having me.
And hopefully we can get you back on soon, since there's so much more to talk about.
That concludes part two of our interview with Dan Cohen. I want to thank our patrons for their monthly support. Because of your support, we were able to give you early access to part two of this interview. To those of you who are regular listeners and for people who stumbled upon this interview with Dan Cohen, I want to encourage you to become patrons of the Unauthorized Disclosure podcast, particularly if you appreciated the kind of discussion we had with Dan, the sort of length, the detail, and how comprehensive we were in our discussion. Most of our interviews are of this nature, and so I think you will find, if you want more content like that, you could go to our website, patreon.com/unauthorizeddisclosure, and you can become a patron today. We'd really appreciate having your support. We have about 200 patrons at the moment. We're working on getting together a very special episode that's been in the works for a little over a month now, but we're going to make good on our promise to reward our patrons who have made us a strong show and continue to give us the ability to grow. So once again, thanks everyone for listening to the Unauthorized Disclosure podcast, and we'll be back soon.